after four people were killed in Chippewa Falls last month, as well as the perpetrator who took his own life. The Chippewa County Sheriff suggested the perpetrator may have been trying to imitate the kidnapping of Jamie Kloss and the murder of her parents in 2018. The phenomenon is often called copycat killing, and research has shown that when certain acts of violence get intense media coverage, they can inspire others to commit similar acts. There's a growing push from experts like our next guest for media outlets to rethink their coverage of incidents like mass shootings. Pete Blair is a professor of criminal justice and the executive director of the Advanced Law Enforcement Rapid Response Training Center at Texas State University. He also helps run the Don't Name Them campaign, which advocates for the media to rethink their reporting on incidents like mass shootings. Pete, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
What is it about coverage of acts of mass violence that can inspire other people to commit similar acts?
Well, the major thing we see in a lot of these cases is that the attackers have a desire for notoriety or fame. And when they get wall-to-wall coverage of their life, their personality, their history, their manifesto gets published, that serves to encourage them to engage in that activity in the future.
Tell us what researchers call the contagion effect.
So the contagion effect is the idea that when there is large media coverage that happens, or a large amount of it that happens, people see that coverage and it encourages them to commit similar acts.
And how do we know that media coverage is part of what drives perpetrators of mass violence?
Well, probably the biggest study that's been done on that is by Sherry Towers out of Arizona State University, and she looked at contagion effect as it relates to mass shootings and found that the more publicity coverage there was of a large event, the more likely it was that there'd be another event that would follow in about a couple week period after that.
And the phrase copycat killings is often used, but you say the copycat isn't really the right term to describe these crimes. What's a better way to talk about them?
Yeah, when we're talking about mass shootings, what we see is the shooters are studying the ones who came before them to look for ways to improve the amount of damage, the number of people that are injured in their attacks. So going all the way back to what we would call the modern era of active shooter events, that would be 1999 with the Columbine High School shooting. You'll still see shooters today referring back to that case and those people as kind of role models for them and what they're trying to do. But then they'll go through and look at more recent cases looking for what people did that increased the number of casualties that occurred. And even in some of the dark web areas and the online chats that happen, they will critique attacks and say, well, if they had done this, they could have hurt more people.
I hate to say it, but it almost sounds like they're using previous media reporting as almost a how-to manual.
That's exactly what you see.
And I was struck by how much Columbine stands out in all of this. As you said, 20 years ago, a lot of the shooters who might follow in those footsteps were either not even born or were not of an age where they were even probably seeing it as it happened. Why is that so large in the landscape of these mass killings?
Well, as I said, we use that incident as to mark what we would call the beginning of the modern era of active shooter events. There were events before that, like the Texas Tower shooting and other events that had occurred. But that one was the first one that really got wall-to-wall media coverage. There was a lot of coverage. It hit at the right time to go on to primetime media. And there was a lot that went on as far as talking about the attackers and who they were and life histories and that sort of thing. And so I think it kind of set the model for how the events were covered from there forward. And so we see it referred back to by the attackers and by researchers.
The Columbine perpetrators, as well as many other perpetrators of these mass shooting events, they themselves die at the event, whether at their own hand or at the hand of law enforcement. Does that either make them even larger in that pantheon, or does that diminish at all the desire of people to follow in their footsteps?
Well, there absolutely can be a martyrdom type effect, and that seems to be the case in some circumstances. But what we've seen now is at least the suicide rate on scene has started to go down in more recent events. And so people are trying to survive because they see things like Aurora and the court trial that shooter gets. And that encourages them to say, well, this is a way to get my story out there even more and to stay in the limelight longer.
So staying alive is a way to even further aggrandize their image of themselves.
Exactly.
We're talking with Pete Blair right now. He's a professor of criminal justice at Texas State University, also the executive director of the Advanced Law Enforcement Rapid Response Training Center there, and he helps run the Don't Name Them campaign. We're talking about what role the media can play in discouraging people from imitating mass shootings and other tragedies. And this idea of not providing encouragement or excess publicity to events like this, and limiting that contagion effect. This is not the first time or the first topic where this has come out. There's also been a lot of talk of contagion effect with suicide. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Yeah, that happened some time ago. Researchers started to look at what appeared to be after where there would be a widely public suicide of a well-known figure, that they'd see an increase in suicide rates for a period of time after that. And the researchers started to look and try to document that, and they were able to document it in several different instances where there was somebody who either had a very widely publicized suicide or a very well-known public figure committed suicide, and then you'd see that spike in the suicide rates. And the media looked at those and said, you know, maybe we ought to change how we cover suicides now so that we're not feeding into that phenomena.
And what have those changes looked like?
Well, it's basically just shifting the coverage away from trying to give the details and the nitty-gritty about it and making it kind of just a piece that said this suicide happened, and not dwell on it and move forward.
I want to talk about some of the lessons perhaps that the media, we in the media, can take from that, those guidelines for suicide. So one of the things that has been suggested strongly, and obviously your group puts it right in the name, not naming the perpetrators, not focusing on the perpetrators. What is the hope if we do not name the person who has committed that atrocity?
So this is Crime Prevention 101, and if you think back to in the 80s when we had a lot of convenience store robberies that were happening because there was a lot of cash at a convenience store because of alcohol, cigarette, and gasoline sales, they became very highly targeted locations for robbery. And there was a concerted effort made to look at how can we change what's happening at convenience stores to reduce how often robberies happen there. And there are actually many people being killed during those robberies. And one of the things they came up with, in addition to several other things, was the invention of the drop safe. So now you'll see that all over the country when a cash register will have a sign on it that says when the cash register only has $50, that means that as they pull in more money, they're putting it in a little tube and they're dropping it in the safe, and the safe isn't accessible. And the idea behind that is this concept of reducing rewards. If you reduce the amount that somebody gets or the reward that they get for committing a crime, you reduce the frequency with which the crime happens. And we've seen convenience store robberies drop a lot in more recent years. The idea here is similar, is that if we know one of the things that motivates attackers is a desire for notoriety or fame, if we can reduce the amount of notoriety or fame they get for that, then we should see a decrease in the amount of attacks that happen as well. So that's the basic concept.
And I would say one caveat to that that I've seen in the literature is that this is if either the perpetrator was killed on the scene or is in custody. Obviously, if they are looking for the perpetrator and it's known who that person is, publicizing the name in order for help to catch that person is important.
Absolutely. If it's a public safety issue, you absolutely want to get that name out there and the likeness so that people know who it is and have a chance to help catch them.
We've touched on this a bit, but I'd like to talk a little more about it because I think often, you know, in the media, the emphasis is on giving as much information and details as we are able to. But what we're talking about is that sometimes those details are not necessarily helping the public in any way other than maybe, you know, kind of a perverse fascination with these events. Some of the details are the methods that are used in the attacks, what kind of guns were used, the tactical clothing that were worn. Are there ways to responsibly cover this and both be providing the audience service that we need to, but also keeping these cautions in mind?
Sure. What we would recommend is we know the name is going to get out there. So at some point it's going to come out. What we're recommending is not focusing on that attacker and giving that notoriety or fame that they're looking for. So instead it's appropriate to focus on the heroes, where they're there, the community and what the community can do to protect themselves, as well as the signs that we see that oftentimes occur before one of these events happens. And then specific actions during an event, if you should find yourself in that event, you can take to protect yourself. So there are things like that that can be talked about. The specifics of the case, really, there's not as much variation as people think. There's a pretty well-understood process that we typically see with these attackers. And so while it can be interesting to see what happened with this particular person, it's generally not very different from previous events that we've seen.
We're picking up our conversation with Pete Blair. He's the executive director of the Advanced Law Enforcement Rapid Response Training Center and a professor of criminal justice at Texas State University. He's with us today to talk about the role the media plays in times of mass violence and the effect its coverage can have on others who may be thinking about committing similar acts. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think the media gets right when it's covering these events, and what does it get wrong? Do you think there's a way to minimize the coverage of perpetrators while balancing the public's right to know? And what questions do you have for our guest about the role media coverage plays in mass violence? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. And let's go to the phones, and Dennis in Two Rivers is up. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, I've got a comment and a question. First, the comment is we need to be careful about privacy of the victims, because whether it's Jamie Coss or somebody else, they want to be able to get past this. And if somebody keeps bringing this up, it's hard for them to really get through it and get over it, I think. Plus, I just wonder, is this somewhat like the old West gunslinger or a gunfighter type thing, where they're just trying to come up with some kind of reputation, even if they die doing it?
That's a good question, Dennis. Thank you. And Pete?
I think the comment about the victims is right on. You have to be very sensitive to what they want and what will help them. And for some families, that's going to be they don't want to be in the spotlight at all or talk about it at all publicly. For others, it seems to be very cathartic. So I think it's an individual basis for the victims. As far as the idea of reputation, yeah, we live in a culture that is worried about fame, and it's no longer that important about how you get that fame. What matters is that you have it. So if you think back to Paris Hilton and various people like that who are famous for being famous without good cause, that seems to be the modern culture. And this is one way of acquiring that fame.
One of the issues is that it isn't just the act that this perpetrator commits. It is also manifestos and social media postings, even sometimes videos that these perpetrators have created. How should materials like that be treated?
I wouldn't publish them widely at all. These are materials that if they hadn't committed this horrific act would never be out there. You would never see them. You would never hear about them, even if they were online. But they do this horrific act, and now all of a sudden they're thrust into the spotlight and everybody sees them, everybody reads them, everybody comments on them.
Tell us a little more about the Don't Name Them campaign and what your team is trying to do.
Well, what we've talked about here is essentially the Don't Name Them campaign. We're not very formal in what we do, but whenever we can talk to media and try to increase people's sensitivity to that, we do that. So we talk to media outlets. We also talk to law enforcement executives around the country and public information officers so that they're aware of this. We just want to put it on people's radar so that they think through it. They have an opportunity before they're thrust into a crisis situation to come up with what they think the best approach would be. And then, you know, our alert center itself also will help support media outlets by giving them B-roll and putting people on to talk about the events when they occur without focusing on the attacker, to help out that way.
And I wanted to talk about the role of law enforcement, actually, because you are the executive director of Advanced Law Enforcement Rapid Response Training Center. I'm assuming that a lot of the people that you deal with through that work are people who would be either at the center of events like this or at the very least involved. How do you counsel them in the ways that they provide information to the public and to the media?
a lot of it in the same way that we talk about it here is making them aware of this idea that people want notoriety or fame and we should try to avoid that. We talk that to them about shifting away to what people can do to protect themselves, about addressing the immediate crisis, making sure people know if there's any ongoing risk or not, that that's been concluded, but really focusing away from the actual attacker themselves. Sheriff Hanlon was probably a big example of that, and while we didn't train him or coach him to do that, we thought his approach was a strong approach to say, look, I'm not going to name this guy publicly. The information will get out to you. We're not trying to suppress it, but we're not going to make this person an instant media sensation by putting their name out there at the outset of this investigation.
I want to listen to New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern. Here she is talking after the attacks in Christchurch, New Zealand this past March.
He sought many things from his act of terror, but one was notoriety. And that is why you will never hear me mention his name. He is a terrorist. He is a criminal. He is an extremist. But he will, when I speak, be nameless.
I remember when she made those comments, it was a very powerful statement. Is this an idea, a concept that is getting a lot of traction?
Well, it varies off and on. We have had some media outlets and some big name personalities say that they won't be talking about the names of the attackers or putting them in the forefront. Other places have been more resistant to that. And that's part of our ongoing education campaign to continue that conversation and that talk and make sure people are aware of the issues and encourage them to do what we think would be the right decision.
We're talking with Pete Blair. He's a professor of criminal justice at Texas State University, and we're talking about responsible media coverage of mass shootings. And let's go to the phone, and Matt in Stanley is up. Hi, Matt.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Well, I guess a very interesting topic. I agree wholeheartedly with it, and parts of me kind of don't agree with it. Just kind of thinking back to probably one of the more recent, at least school shootings down in Florida, where 20-some individuals lost their lives. There was a gentleman in there, well, not so much of a gentleman, that went into that school and committed 20-some capital murders. Now, I don't know what his name is, and probably neither one of you do, because that's not what the media concentrated. And the problem is if you take the perpetrator who commits capital murder out of it, well, then who are you? Who and what are you going to blame?
Thank you for that call, Matt. And actually, Pete, that brings up an interesting thing. What would fill the void if we do pull back on that kind of information?
Well, again, there are other sorts of information that are more useful. So if you look at the pattern that led to this attacker's attack, and I know who the attacker was.
I guessed you might.
and you can find it if you look for it. We see a very common pattern here that there were warning signs that happened beforehand. This wasn't just a spur of the moment thing where this person got angry and launched this attack, and there were things that could be detected. So talking about that pattern, that downward spiral that people often enter before these events is helpful so that people understand what the warning signs are, as well as then making sure that they report those warning signs to authorities, which was done in this case, but unfortunately he was low priority on the radar at the time.
And Pete, what kind of changes do you hope to see having gotten put into place in, say, 5 years from now?
I would love to see when the coverage happens that the coverage immediately shifts away from the attacker, instead focusing on the communities, the victims where it's appropriate, the heroes, what people can do to protect themselves, what the pattern is that leads to this. And then I would hope that that would also be tied in with a decrease in how many of these events happen.
And do you have ideas for where people in the media or any people can learn more about this issue and educate themselves on why this might be an important approach to take?
Sure. We have our Don't Name Them website. It's don'tnamethem.org. And then you can always contact the Advanced Law Enforcement Rapid Response Training Center at Texas State University. That's alert2rs.org. And we'll be happy to take any queries you have and direct you anything we can to help out.
Well, Pete, thank you so much for spending the time with us. It's an important topic, and we were grateful for your time.
Thanks for having me on.
That was Pete Blair, a professor of criminal justice at Texas State University and part of the Don't Name Them campaign. He's also the director of the Advanced Law Enforcement Rapid Response Training Center. We spoke with him about the issue of copycat or imitative crimes, mass shootings, and other acts of violence in the wake of a shooting in Chippewa Falls recently.